Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. It's Ailish and Brent filling in this morning for JD, who is probably snoozing away, living the dream. Not our guy, Rick in Niagara, though, who got up to help his wife this morning. Not the fake grinder. He goes, coffee is ready. Wife still asleep. Going to empty the dishwasher before she gets up. Husband of the year.
No, I'm going the other way. passive aggressive. It can be a little loud emptying
That's
said
true.
Dishwasher.
Clanking.
What's all that clanking downstairs? Mm-hmm. Me grinding while you are snoozing.
You're right. There's an angle there.
And here's the thing. It can be both. It can be a loving gesture of support while also tweaking. Because it's what we do to the people in our life that we love the most is, yeah, we give them support and we love them. But you got to give a little shot, little poke here or there.
Ooh, gotta do it. Rick in Niagara. I don't know. Maybe I'll revoke husband of the year. Someone that did get up nice and early for us. No complaints. Shane Ryan, writer at Golf Digest and author of Ryder Cup, The Cup They Couldn't Lose. Good morning, Shane. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
We are just, it never ends with the drama, Liv and PGA, but we know that there was this tight-lipped meeting that just happened. Tiger Woods, Rory McIlroy, a bunch of other top golfers. Nobody really wants to say what happened, but what do we actually know when I'm behind closed doors?
Yeah, I think it is like very hush-hush, but you can take a good guess that it was Tiger Woods basically trying to, and Rory, trying to sort of rally the troops and circle the wagons or whatever cliche you want to pick, but basically trying to make the point that this is really bad for our sport. And anyone who goes is hurting not only the PGA Tour, but the sport of golf in general. So don't. You know, stay put, hold strong. And, yeah, I mean, I think really that's the message. It's, you know, we've seen in the past how divisions in sports like boxing or, you know, IndyCar in the 70s in the U.S., they can really decimate a sport that, you know, is pretty popular, and it can happen really quickly. And I think people know that. So I think that's the main message is just, you know, let's try to limit the damage. There's been a lot of damage already. Let's try to kind of stop it where it is.
How important is having Tiger so like forward facing in all this? He's very, you know, never really seen around the media outside of tournaments. Like he's a quiet guy. He flies to Delaware, gets off the private plane. I think that that adds just some serious importance about what's going on, and him being so involved in the face of this, I'm sure is really helping the PGA with the, with their upper hand here.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's big. He, obviously, he's the biggest figure in our sport by a country mile. And you know, he's offered a lot of money. Not that he needs it, but you know, he barely plays anymore, and he could have cashed in for almost $1 billion to go play and live. So the fact that he didn't do it, that's really big, first of all. And, yeah, I mean, to whatever extent, you know, he's always been a private person, and mm-hmm. I can't imagine he's gung-ho about having anything to do with this. You know, I don't think it's his probably favorite thing to do, but anytime you can get him out there, and show, you know, a little bit of solidarity. This is the guy that all the great players of the current generation grew up watching him, and he's the person they all look up to. So that is big, you know, and it's not everything, right? I mean, money talks, and, you know, Cam Smith is going, and I don't, you know, when somebody dangles hundreds of millions of dollars in front of you, I don't necessarily always think having one guy like Tiger Woods say, don't do this, is going to be decisive, and it's not all the time, but yeah, I mean, symbolically, I think it is a pretty big deal.
I like to think of it as that scene from Godfather 1 where Don Corleone is with all the other five families and he's like, I'm a superstitious man, and if anything should befall my beloved PGA Tour, that I will not forgive. Like, it does feel like he is just laying down the gauntlet of, look, guys, I am the man. I am still the lead star for this sport. I am still the thing that everyone follows. And this is where your legacy can best be protected. This where you can best build things. It's just, it is incredible to me the fact that he has so firmly been able to kind of have it best of both worlds. That he comes out and makes his little comments, but he doesn't have to be like Rory, where it's week in and week out giving a public state of the battle. It's like, oh, the front this week has been so tough for our dear PGA Tour. tour guys. Like, that's what it feels like Rory has to go through every week. And it's just, I have to commend Tiger. You know, there's been a million things he's done for the game. But if he is able to help in any way, hold this off or hold the line, I it's just incredible how it can kind of add to his legacy as a player in the game. You know, Arnold Palmer is always seen as the guy who helped make it global, right? He went over and won the Open, and Gary Player, of course, is as international a player as there is, and Jack Nicklaus is always going to have the most majors, but it feels like when it's all said and done, if Tiger is able to help win this battle, or however you want to phrase it, for the PGA Tour, it really feels like that can go down. Obviously, his legacy will be as a player, but that can be the, like, subheading, if you will, too. Tiger Woods, the great man who helped save PGA Tour. It feels like it could really be a big, big part of what he's remembered for.
Yeah, well, first of all, I love the idea of Rory in a Ken Burns movie every week, like a Civil War documentary. Like, we suffered greatly in St. Andrews today, mama.
Oh, we all did.
Yeah.
God.
yeah, I know. Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think, you know, to your point, it's like, I don't think he can do it by himself, and I don't think he will. And obviously, we've seen, you know, a lot of good players go already. But I think when you are facing the war chest that the Saudis have, which nobody can come close to matching, not only on the PGA Tour, but on the entire planet, anywhere, I think any little bit of pressure you can bring to bear is important. And I think, you know, the social pressure is one sort of element of that, and that's part of what Tiger is doing. You know, I heard a story, Hudson Swafford is one of the guys who went, and he's one of the ones you kind of raise your eyebrow at a little bit, right? He's not one of the, you know, 45-year-old Europeans sort of cashing in one last time. But anyway, he lives on Sea Island, which is, you know, I think the second biggest, like, golf community among PGA Tour players after Jupiter, Florida. And he's, you know, pretty much been ostracized there. And that's a big deal, right? I mean, he lives there, and, like, his social circle is all PGA Tour golfers. And there's, you know, there's stories of, oh, he was accidentally left on a text chain where they were all kind of, like, ragging on him. And yeah, I mean, that's like his whole thing. And so, yeah, these guys, I think it's just like every little thing that you can do, right? So it's like PGA Tour is going to increase their money to whatever extent they can. It's not going to match the Saudis, but you are going to have more opportunities to make a few extra million if you're very good. You know, there's social consequences. There is the PR consequences where you're going to get, you know, a little flack in the media and all that kind of stuff. All this stuff adds up, and, you know, it's like a maybe, right? I mean, you weigh that on the scales and Tiger Woods, and you weigh that on the scales against hundreds of billions of dollars and, you know, see how it plays out. But it's been quite an adventurous and strange and curious few months here in professional golf.
So when you look at how the PGA players are kind of banding together, do you feel like they have a sense of renewed power? Like, this is an organization that's never really been known to have much of a willingness to change. And they've been able to have that hand in, as you mentioned, a lot of different rules changing, the purse increasing. Do they have a position of power right now?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's leverage there for sure. I would add that, you know, the PGA Tour is a players' organization. It's not a players' union, right, by any means. But this is like an organization that, with their profits, you know, supported, you know, let's say, you know, PGA Tour Canada, PGA Tour Latin America, Asian tours that they ran, all the minor league tours in the U.S., the Corn Ferry Tour. So it is a zero-sum game in some ways. It's not like they're paying, you know, like a normal American company where your CEO is making hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, it's not like Jay Monahan is going to go poor or anything, but they're using their money to support kind of an entire network of golf around, not just in America, but around the country. So there is a give and take. So right now, yeah, they are compelled to pay their stars a lot more money because they're trying to keep everybody by any means that they can. And they're changing the formats, but, you know, you're going to feel that on the other side. So I think it's a good thing in some ways, but in other ways, it does make me hesitant of, like, yeah, you're, you know, with the Saudis and with the way the PGA Tour is changing, you're going to leave somebody out. And I think quite often those somebodies are going to be the, you know, the pros aspiring to make a career in this game, who are going to see, you know, their side of the game dry up financially a little bit.
Yeah, that's always been a hard part of the game, right? Is trying to find those minor leagues, for lack of a better term. Obviously, now the Korn Ferry Tour has been able to graduate guys, but you know they have the new PGA Tour U. It's kind of tough to make the leap out of those places. You know, I do want to talk to you about Cam Smith, a guy who is rumored as good as gone. He's the lone major winner from this year who is expected to leave. Do you think it does anything for the tour? That look, I know Phil and Hideki both won last year, and one of them's for sure gone, and Hideki, much like Cam Smith, is rumored to be gone. But if you look at the last major winners, you know, it's not like they're losing 7 of 8. There are still a lot of the, and it's not just the high-profile guys. It is the guys who have most recently won the most high-profile tournaments. Like, how much do you think it helps the tour that it hasn't been this max exodus of recent major winners? And yes, like, all very important players. I'm not trying to sugarcoat that, but the fact that it hasn't been a Morikawa, it hasn't been a John Rahm, guys like that, that have left. Do you think that, how much does that kind of help the tour kind of stem this tide as well?
Yeah, it's important. You know, you look at certain guys and you think, you're kind of like, well, if this person went, that would be maybe not death, but, you know, close to the tipping point where you just sort of give up, right? And there were rumors that Morikawa was going for a while. And to me, that was devastating. You know, that was like, and he came out and said, they're not true. That's, you know, I'll let you know, but it's not happening. But yeah, like somebody like that would be huge. Really, I mean, you know, to put a fine point on it, there are young Americans, right, that if they win, it would be quietly devastating. And, you know, and not just Americans. Rory would be the same way. But yeah, if you lost a Scottie Scheffler, if you lost a Colin Morikawa, Jordan Spieth, or somebody like that. And then, yeah, like John Rahm, same thing. You know, a Spanish guy like that would be big. I will say Cam Smith, I think, is the biggest by far. That was
for sure.
To have a guy not only beat Rory at the Open Championship, but then immediately all these rumors circulate. I'm talking immediately that day, the day that he's winning, rumors circulate that he's gone. I mean, that was awful, right? I mean, that was a really, really low moment. And that was the first one where you're like, okay, here's a young guy who is, you can't sugarcoat it, right? I mean, this guy is great. He's a great
cool
player.
He's so cool.
Yeah, he's cool customer. Yeah, he's like, he's an interesting guy. And you go, why is he doing this, right? Like, why are you going to the competitive graveyard of this stupid, like, team event golf thing when you're already, like, right, he's going to win probably, like, you know, $10 million in the next 2 weeks here. He's already a very rich person. And it's very, like, very discouraging. And so you go,
Shane, well, sorry. Shane, let me just jump in on that. This just came back to me, and I'm sure other people have connected the dots here, but it cannot be overstated when we're talking about Cam Smith. This is the same guy who, when he got asked what he would do if he won the FedEx Cup last year, so a year ago when he had made less money, was like, my life's pretty set. It wouldn't change anything, maybe I'd buy some fishing stuff, and all of a sudden I got to take the money from the Saudis. Like, I just connected those dots in my head, and I had to throw that at you. Like, it is mind-blowing to me that he ended up doing that, given that that was his answer less than a year ago.
Yeah, I think, you know, I remember after he won the Players Championship, he actually withdrew from the WGC, the match play, and his big thing was he hadn't seen his family in a really long time because of the pandemic. And his mom had come over, and, you know, that was a big thing for him, to be able to see his family. So the really generous interpretation, I don't know if it's right, but maybe he thought, you know, look, I'm from Australia. I'm an Australian person. My entire family and everybody is there. I need a more, you know, balanced schedule. And if I can get $300 million or whatever to do it, maybe this is a career move I make so that I'm not spending my entire life away from my family. I don't know if that's the case, but that's one thing where you go, maybe. But even then, you know, now they're expanding to 14 events next year. It's not that different, right? And they're going to be all over the world too. So, yeah, it's like, it is a big mystery for me with Cam Smith, and I hope one day we find out, because it doesn't seem, you know, if you're a competitive person, don't you want to play against the best people? I mean, you know, there's threats of not being able to play in the majors. There's all these questions where you go, what are you thinking? But again, I do think it's one of those ones you can't sugarcoat. This is not a 50-year-old European. This guy is really, really good and young, charismatic, and, you know, it stinks to lose him.
I just wish they all did the Pat Perez and just wore a money shirt to their welcome to live party and not try to sugarcoat about time with my family and all this. Like, you nailed it there. It is so incredibly frustrating. I think for me, and I'm realizing in my heart of hearts this is pie-in-the-sky thinking, but I'm still holding out hope, and I know holding out hope for this particular body to do the right thing is a wild thing. But it feels to me like it's Augusta or bust in terms of holding the line for the PGA Tour. If there's a world where Augusta comes out, and I don't know that they'd ban past champions, but they would say, if you were not a past champion and you were affiliated with LIV, you are not coming to the Masters going forward. It feels to me like that is the only thing left. I know that the world ranking points are in 2 to 3 years going to start to affect some of these guys, a Cam Smith type guy, although he's going to be in majors for the next five after that win. It feels to me like Augusta is the only chance in this left. The PGA Tour has said their piece. Tiger said their piece. Rory says his piece 15 times a day because he is the chief PR officer for the tour. And it just feels like if Augusta National comes out and lays down the hammer, that's the only thing that can kind of stop this. And I just don't think they have it in them. Not that they wouldn't want to set the rules, but I don't think they want to be at the center of it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I thought it was a big mistake not for the other majors not to act quickly. And it was very easy for the U.S. Open, for the RNA, for, you know, the PGA to say, look, this is all happening really fast. We have our qualification rules. We can't do anything about it. That makes sense, kind of, in a way. But then you look at it and you go, you are dealing with an existential threat to your sport, and it's a powerful threat. It's a threat like nothing you've ever seen before. Special times call for special measures. I really wish they had reacted fast and said, boom, right away this year, 2022, nobody is playing in these majors if you're affiliated with LIV Golf. It would have been a drastic step, but I think it might have been the only thing. And yeah, to your point, I think it's still Augusta is the one that really didn't have to make the decision yet. I think it might be a little bit more likely than you think. I don't think it's totally pie in the sky, and I don't have any inside dope on this, but just the kind of stuff you hear, it may happen. And yeah, it would be huge. I mean, golf is a weird thing like tennis where, for whatever historical reason, the biggest tournaments of the year are these four tournaments run by organizations that are outside, you know, the week-to-week main governing body. And they have this imbalanced power. So if they were to make a big call like that, yeah, that could be really decisive and it could be a really huge blow. But you have to remember, yeah, not only is it easy not to do that, but also if you do it, you're going to deal with lawsuits and, you know, it's the whole circus.
I think those guys got pretty good lawyers, I got to say. At Augusta, I feel like they got the best ones.
Yeah. They might be the ones that are willing to do it, right? There's a certain arrogance at Augusta National, too. You can see them being like, yeah, we're the guys that are going to fight this. So I would, you know, I would love it, personally.
Yes.
I would hope that it happens, but no inside joke. But, yeah, I agree with you that would be a huge thing and one of the last really big weapons remaining.
Well, Shane, appreciate you joining us this morning. It's good that they're giving us content to talk about in a slow summer. We will definitely catch up with you down the road. I'm sure there'll be more lawsuits and more information on what the hell Patrick Reed is also doing. We'll get that from you next.
All right. Yeah, thank you all. I appreciate you having me on.
Always fun, Shane.
Yeah,
thanks.
So great. Thanks, Shane. Shane Ryan, writer at Golf Digest and author of the Ryder Cup, the cup they couldn't lose. Take a look at that. Yeah, man, it's great. We didn't get into the Patrick Reed stuff, but what was it, like $750 million lawsuit?
Here's all you need to know.
Nuts.
Here's all you need to know. There's a guy in golf, for those who are not super plugged in, as close as the golf world can come to a Stephen A. Smith type is Brandon Chamblee. He is throwing takes. He's saying, I don't like this guy. He's saying this guy is a cheater and all this. And he goes at Patrick Reed. Patrick Reed said, look, this guy's a failed player in his lawsuit, and that's why he's coming at me. The drama is wonderful. He's going to lose the lawsuit 1,000%. You can't say this guy's a meanie to me and get $750 mil. Look, I know if you could do it anywhere, it'd be America, but I still don't even think there you could do that. So there's the Coles notes of Patrick Reed.
Well, that's something to chew on. And also something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, 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 yum. Oh, that's a new one. I only heard you when I was doing it.
I don't know who that is. That's not me. Oh, that's you, Gunning. What?
That's me.
Oh, my God. You have to play mine now because they get mad.
Yum, yum, yum.
The text line guys, like some of them, they really like hearing yum, yum, yum.
It's not creepy at all.
It's a bit of a kink, I think. Okay, so something that you want isn't the ketchup ice cream cones, thank God. It is, though, that LeBron James just signed a 2-year contract, $97.1 million contract extension, including a player option for the 2024-25 season. It really paves the way.
I love this.
To be available when his son Bronny enters the 2024 NBA draft. I really think that this is happening. He's laid it out perfectly. I'll be 39, welcoming a contract wherever you want me. You better draft my son.
I love it. Here's the thing. LeBron has three things left to accomplish in the league. He needs to pass Kareem for the all-time scoring title, and that's just a fact that so long as he does not get hit by an asteroid, that's going to happen. Okay, he would like to win more championships. Of course, he'd still love to get to six. The way the career's going, I don't know that that's going to happen, but obviously that is still an important thing. And it has been clear as day for a really, really long time that if it is all possible, he would love to hang around long enough to play in the league with his son. Why wouldn't he? He's LeBron. He has always been, like, I am as big a LeBron guy as it gets. One of these pictures that you can see over my shoulder here, Ailish, is a framed picture of LeBron James, okay? I love the guy. Absolutely adore him. But here's the thing. He has always made his situation exactly what he wants it and exactly what benefits him. Now, because he's LeBron, that's almost always a good thing for your team. But this doesn't surprise me at all. And honestly, I love it. The one thing there's a million things that separate the two guys, but in terms of personality-wise, it's like LeBron has always been Mr. Family Man. Jordan was Mr. Ruthless Killer. And how fitting would it be that LeBron sticks around long enough to get to do it? I think it'd be awesome. And yeah, who knows if his kids is any good or not. I mean,
yeah, I don't know. He's been sharing so many videos of his son, like, obviously, but like, oh my goodness, Bronny with the dunk. Like, every time that this kid does something, it's blasted on social media. Like, he's really helping boost his draft stock, and I think he actually has over the last couple months actually started to rise up the rankings. I'm not, you know, a huge draft ranking follower 3 years in advance, but I do see a lot of Bronny propaganda as of late on Twitter, so I don't know. It would be really cool to see. I wonder what his quality of play will be in two seasons, enough so that a team will do it. They'll take a flyer on it. It's LeBron James. He's going to retire with your team. That's the thing.
That's so. It. You'd get LeBron.
It's pretty cool.
In his dying years. And we played Stephen A. Smith earlier on the show. If we're going to talk about LeBron James and his kid, I don't know if you saw this, the Skip Bayless tweet, as everyone was sharing this dunk of his kid. Hey, Bronny, impressive, but your dad would have dunked it left-handed. You sure got away with it, though.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Like, what a hater.
Yeah,
what
a hater. The kid's like, yeah, let him be. He's just growing into his own. Like, you don't need to shut him down like that so early. But, yeah, let's get Bayless.
Well, look, here's the thing. You got to be great at what you're great at. And that man is great at hating LeBron James and anything that's in his orbit. So stick to your brand and be who you are, I guess, is what we can learn from that. I would love to see it. I mean, Griffey played with his dad. The Howes played together. It's just as rare a thing as you could possibly see. And honestly, with the way sports is going, it feels like, well, actually, those are both examples of this as well. You have to have a legendary senior figure and somebody who breaks into the leagues early. And obviously, you know, LeBron is as legendary a guy as there is currently in the NBA. And his kid, again, who knows? Like, it's is he going to get gifted? Here's the thing. We could say the quiet part out loud. Is there a world where LeBron James' kid gets gifted an NBA roster spot that he probably doesn't 100%. Deserve so that they can get LeBron James? 100%. Guess what? A lot of people have jobs because of who their mom or dad is. So let's not get too bent out of shape about it with LeBron and Bronny is where I fall.
Before we take a break and talk more contracts with Luke Fox and lack of contracts, we got to just pop in a couple texts here. It is pronounced Jip Rock. I appreciate that. All the people that texted in, all our construction workers, and did pronounce that correctly. Short for gypsum, the material that it is made from. So learning something new every day. I really do
agree with what you said on the text line, though. Still sounds fake.
It's like agree with that. Jip Rock? I don't know.
Still sounds fake.
It's because it's like gypsy. Yeah, like that says mysticalness around it. I think they're all pulling on that tail. Okay, Matt Newmarket, he texted in a prank. We were having a Christmas party. Someone got a little too drunk. His shoes ended up in the freezer overnight. It reminds me of the Office episode where Kevin goes to Pam and Jim's wedding and he has to put his feet in the ice box because my dogs are barking.
Oh, so good.
Oh, yeah. And he had to wear those Kleenex boxes because threw his.
Now, I got to be honest. I don't know about you, but like when I've had a couple of cervezas. The body can get running a little hot.
Oh, yeah.
Could you imagine slipping on some ice cold shoes? It might be a shock.
That actually might be a thing.
Yeah, I know. I feel like that's not a prank. I feel like they're starting a budding cryotherapy business for late night at the bar or something like that. Get the shoes in the freezer, put them on, wake you up. Mm-hmm. I love it. Here we go.
You're into it. I will say I used to have to take an ice bath after every practice and game at college because I had hip surgery and you just really needed to soothe the hips every time I went on the ice. And I was so soft. I would have to wear these little foot sock things that are made out of that material that you go scuba diving in. What's that called?
Oh, yeah, like neoprene.
Yeah, foot socks, because I couldn't do it. Like, if my toes went in there, I would just, you have to wait the 5 minutes for them to go numb. I was soft. I couldn't do it. So I don't know if I could survive the foot shoes, the ice cold shoes, because I have sensitive toes, apparently.
I couldn't do the ice bath, so you're tougher than me.
But
so
it was the best. But you had to go through the pain for a couple minutes there.
No pain, no gain.
No pain,
the
no
grinders
gain.
Know. The grinders know.
Let's take a break, talk some hockey, some more ice. Luke Fox, Sportsnet NHL writer who broke the news on the Sandin front, having absolutely no news. That's next on the Fan Morning Show with Brent and Ailish, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Morning shows, 4.5.90 The Fan, Brent Gunning and Ailish this morning. I like the song selection. It's all right, because I hope it will be all right with Sandin and the news that our next guest, Luke Fox, Sportsnet NHL writer, broke yesterday. Luke, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Yeah, happy to be on talking some hockey in the middle of August.
Haven't
heard that Maxine Nightingale song for a long time.
Yeah, we needed it this morning.
Well, we need Leafs wins for those in the playoffs, Luke. So,
We do. It's been a while since we had some hockey to talk, but you dropped some significant news yesterday. Sandin and his agent, no progress. Negotiations are going nowhere. First of all, was this did you reach out to this guy? How did this come about? You just kind of snuck in on us yesterday.
Well, I caught wind that, things weren't going well. So I gave Rasmus Sandin's agent, Louis Gross, a call yesterday. And he didn't want to say much. I asked him a bunch of follow-up questions, but he clearly wanted to get the message out there that negotiations are going nowhere. That was the line he was sticking with. And that's significant because a lot of these negotiations with Kyle Dubas, especially since Louis Gross's other client, William Nylander, thinks things went so sideways a few years ago in that negotiation when Nylander was coming off his RFA deal and went all the way down to the wire. I'm sure fans remember down to December 1st. Dubas has kind of adopted the Lou Lamoriello style of, we're not going to negotiate in public. We prefer that the agents that represent our players don't really say anything on the record. They like to keep things quiet when it comes to this. But, I think most fans and certainly people in the media knew that things were getting tense here. And the fact that RFA, Pierre Engvall, Timothy Liljegren was in a very similar boat to Sandin. They got their deals sorted very quickly, and it's been more than a month since Sandin has been a restricted free agent, and still no progress. So there's tension there because how does he fit in contract wise? The Leafs are technically at the cap ceiling already, and then how does he fit in terms of where he plays? He prefers to play the left side. Dubas has said that he likes Sandin on the left side. But then you look at the left side depth chart, and how is a young 22-year-old with limited experience and already, battled some injuries early in his career going to leap over the likes of Mark Giordano, Jake Muzzin, Morgan Rielly? So it's quite a bit of a pickle that these guys find themselves in right now.
So much to unpack there, and I want to get into the William Nylander connection and where Sandine might fit and maybe what the biggest issue is here. But you mentioned something at the start of your answer about his agent, you know, wanting to kind of get this information in the news. Yep. And I wondered about the timing of this and that specific information that leaked in the wording. Did you get the incentive or the idea that was really one of the main driving factors of what he had to say and the tight-lipped about it? Is this putting maybe the Leafs in a position that they need to move on?
Well, there's only so many ways that Lewis Gross can exert any pressure on Dubas. So because Sandine is young, he doesn't have any arbitration rights, and that's usually the way to go if you want to put pressure on a team to get a deal done. The only other options he has is to seek out an offer sheet. The fact that that hasn't happened yet leads me to believe that it's probably unlikely that that's going to happen. Just normally we see offer sheets pretty quickly. Sandine could have signed one long ago, over a month ago now. It hasn't happened, even though I think he'd be a candidate. Part of that, I think, is because he wants to. I think he, in a perfect world, he wants to remain a Leaf. That's my opinion. So the player has to actually go out and be willing to sign with another team to make that happen. The other thing is, most of the good teams are at the cap already. There's just not enough, money floating around the NHL because the cap hasn't risen at the rate teams expected it to. So they don't have a lot of extra money to go and try to poach Sandine from the Leafs, the good teams at least. So that's the other thing. So the only way to apply pressure is to, for a guy without arbitration rights, is either offer sheet, threaten to sign in the European League, which I think is kind of a flimsy way to flex your muscle, or exert some public pressure, and maybe by getting that message out there, Dubas feels may feel a little bit more pressure. The next pressure point really is day one of training camp, and does he show up or not?
Yeah, that is obviously the next big pressure point. It'll be interesting to see what plays out there. The Nylander parallels are interesting, but they're also, to me, very different situations. William Nylander was not the established bona fide player that he is now in the NHL when that deal was coming, but obviously he had a much bigger track record of success. It feels to me like with Nylander, the issue was term and money, and not that isn't a bit of the stumbling block for Sandine and the Leafs right now, but it just goes back to what you said about the left side. There's just no home for him. Let's say there was $5 million sitting out there on the cap, and oh man, let's live in that dream world for a second with the Leafs. Or like you said, any decent team in the NHL, let's take the cap out of it for a second. If they could give him exactly the bridge deal he wants, that he's comfortable with, that he's happy with, there's still just not a spot for him on the team. I see people say, oh, you can move out Justin Hall and that opens up a spot. I think Rasmus Sandine, I'm not saying he can never play the right side. I don't want him playing it next year. I want him playing the side he's comfortable on. You mentioned Giordano. He was such an important addition to this team last year. Jake Muzzin, when he's the good Jake Muzzin, is still really, really important, but we didn't see that version all that much. It just, that keeps continuing to be the issue, is even if they were able to figure out the dollars, even if they were able to figure out the term, where is there a world where he can play? Because much like you said about an offer sheet, if that was going to happen, well, if a Jake Muzzin trade was going to happen, or even a Justin Hall for that matter, it feels like that would have already happened by now. I don't see the roadmap to him having a role on this team, and I think that's a bit of a misstep by the Leafs in not having one for him.
Well, they haven't carved out a spot for him on day one, but what team lasts 82 games? Yep. Without needing a seventh defenseman and a quality seventh defenseman, right? Like that's the thing here. Like, what happens if a defenseman goes down in training camp, which is not that uncommon, right? That mm-hmm. The practices are hard, exhibition games. You got guys out there on the opposing team that are out trying to prove themselves. Injuries happen in the preseason, so. That could, change the complexion of the Leafs defense. You need depth, and you need affordable depth. And I think the main sticking point is that Dubas thought, on paper, you look at games played, you look at production, minutes, their role on the team. Timothy Liljegren took a giant step this past season. And I think Dubas was thinking that Sandin would take something similar, you know, 2 years at 1.4. And Sandin probably feels that he is still a step ahead of Liljegren in terms of his potential. And to be honest, I kind of tend to agree with that. I think Sandin has a higher ceiling than Liljegren. But right now, you know, you look at his stats, it's not as if his ice time or his offensive production is popping off the page that he deserves this monster contract. And, you know, the team will be fine. As long as they're healthy, the team will be fine moving on and rolling out an opening night lineup without Sandin in it. I mean, that's how they played the entire playoff series against Tampa. No Sandin, even though he had healed from his knee injury. They didn't feel he was ready to go and one of the best six guys that they could put out there. So that hurts his leverage, right? Like, William Nylander was a significant absence on day one. Sandin won't be as much just because he doesn't have the track record. And that's kind of the crux of the tension, is because Sandin is losing a little bit of patience. He's an eager young guy that wants more. You know, he wants to be an everyday NHLer. And the team kind of feels like, we're a contender. We want to groom you a little bit more. We want you to be a little bit more patient. And he's getting a little bit frustrated. He hasn't said that to me. That's me just sensing that he's getting a little bit frustrated that he doesn't have a permanent role yet.
I'm getting frustrated, and I'm not even him. And I think that's the problem, is that because of the names that were there, you know, if these were other, if Mark Giordano wasn't Mark Giordano, but he was, you know, a much, and I realize he's going to be 39 years old. I think, like, he is getting up there. I'm very aware of this, but it's just, there isn't the bodies where it's easy to say, okay, you're one of the 7D. If you're the 7D, you're going to be the seventh guy a lot of times on this team. And then I think conversely, I think the other part that, you're saying Sandin's not telling it to you. I guarantee you Sandin's not telling me a thing, but I'm looking at it and saying, if he was a right shot, you know, all the minutes that Timothy Liljegren got and all the opportunities that Timothy Liljegren got, those would have gone to Sandin. And it is just, I think that's the part that's got to be driving him nuts, is, we talk about it all the time. The organization has tied those two guys at the hip, and Sandin's sitting there going, and if I shot the other way, I'd be in that spot. And if I shot the other way, I'd have played enough games to have proven my worth beyond what Liljegren just took. Like, I think that's got to be driving a lot of the frustration, is this guy who came in the organization at a similar time, similar pedigree, all that stuff. And just on the happenstance of what hand they shoot with, one guy has gotten a lot more road to run with here in terms of his NHL career than what you've seen with Sandy.
Yeah, and what I think it will come down to, honestly, Gunnar, is like, when he does get in the lineup, he's got to seize it. He's got to make it undeniable that he deserves to be in it. And there's been times where he's shown great flashes. He's had great games, but let's be honest, he's a young defenseman that's still learning, and there's been times where he's been burned. Especially those times when he's been tried on the right side, it doesn't look like a natural good fit for him. He's got to snatch that spot, or else he's going to end up like Travis Dermott, that guy who the fan base absolutely loved. All they saw was potential. He's young and fast and energetic and likable when he's in front of the camera. All those great things. Teammates love him. All those things applied to Travis Dermott, but he never made it undeniable. He never seized that spot in the top four and made it so the coaches trusted him. So if he was healthy, he was absolutely in the lineup. And that's a challenge for a young guy. And it's a really big challenge when you have guys like with the pedigree of Muzzin and of Giordano, who, when they are healthy, Sheldon Keefe trusts those guys to throw them out in a defensive zone draw more than a 22-year-old. That's just a fact right now.
Mm-hmm. Luke, do you get the do you get the idea that these conversations were never anywhere close throughout the summer, and that they've been so far on the opposite end, or that there was some progression and then now there's a bit of a stall, and this is where this kind of information has squeaked out?
I don't think there's been that. I don't think they've ever been that close. Mm. My belief is that Kyle Dubas wanted Sandin to sign a deal similar to Timothy Liljegren's, and that Sandin and his camp wanted more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I don't think it was close, and that and this is just the sense I get. I can't quote people saying this right now, but this is the sense I have, is that it was never that close, and I think it's frustrating both sides.
How different, or how much more money, or is there a different type of contract structure that they're looking for? Like, do you have any insight on that, or is it just like, give us more money, give us the bag?
No, I pestered Gross about that, and he's very tight-lipped. And I think it's all kind of mixed together. It's not just about money. It's not just about term. Mm-hmm. I think role and fit and feeling like I have a spot on the team plays a lot into this. It's not just about dollars and cents, and it's like a matter of bridging a gap of $500,000 or anything. Sandin doesn't have the leverage to command big money, and he certainly does. I can't see a long-term deal happening here. It's got to be a bridge deal. I mean, Engvall signed for 1 year, Liljegren signed for 2 years. The longer you go, the bigger the dollars have to be, because then you're buying more prime years of his career, and it just can't happen with the Leafs salary cap structure unless they trade someone out, mm-hmm. because it just, the math doesn't work.
Before we let you go, you mentioned trade someone out. Any idea if that's anything in the works, a Hall, a Kerfoot? Like, it's been really quiet, but are they actively trying to move off of those guys?
I can't say for sure that they are. Those guys, their names come up because of their price point and because of Dubas's firm belief that he won't move the big money guys out. So it always circles back to the middle class. That's why Andreas Johnsson went. That's why Kasperi Kapanen went. It always circles back to the middle class, because those are the guys that could provide some salary relief. But it comes with a catch. Mm-hmm. What are you going to get for Justin Hall? What's his market value? What's Alexander Kerfoot's market value? I don't think it's that high. I don't think then it turns into a salary dump. And then, is your team better without an Alexander Kerfoot? Is your team better without a Justin Hall? I know, you know, there's a segment of the fan base that doesn't like him, but you only have two right shot defensemen. If you get him, rid of him in a pure salary dump, you only have one. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to be careful there.
It's quite the conundrum, Luke.
Yes.
Fox. Really appreciate you coming on and giving us the breakdown of this unsettling news.
Yeah, well, and the thing is, it's going to be unsettled, I think, until training camp. It doesn't feel like, it's going to get wrapped up in the next week or two.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, we'll talk to you during training camp then, Luke. Appreciate
okay.
it.
Okay.
Chat soon.
All right. Have a good morning, guys.
You too. Thanks. Luke Fox, Sportsnet NHL writer. I don't I feel a little bit less good after hearing that conversation.
It's just, here's the thing. It just all goes back to, again, it goes back to what I said about the cap. For once, I'm not saying the cap is not an issue. Clearly, there's some dollars that they would like to figure out here. But I firmly believe that if even the money was there, there is still a sticking point of, mm-hmm. okay, you tell me. Like, I just, let's pretend there's not even an agent involved here. It's just Sandin, mm-hmm. and he's just holding up the Leafs depth chart to Kyle Dubas and saying, where?
Yep.
And he's like, right here, just right in this area beneath Jake Muzzin and Giordano and Riley. Okay, so I'm the 7th D again. Mm-hmm. And the name that Luke threw out there in Travis Dermott, and, you know, I'd have to go, I should probably pull up the games played, you know, numbers between the two. And this, just anecdotal, maybe it felt like he was here a lot longer. It felt like Travis Dermott had miles more rope than Sandin has gotten. And this all goes back to, for me, just how sky high I am on the player. I firmly believe the chance that this Leafs team has to add another impact player, or maybe impact is slightly too strong. Obviously, there's Matthew Knies, and who knows what happens when he comes. But I think outside of that, the only player who is poking around in the environment of the Leafs that has a chance to be that guy is Sandin. I firmly believe he can be that player if given the chance, that by the time the playoffs roll around, we're saying, man, where would the Leafs be if they didn't have this guy take the leap he took? Mm-hmm. But the problem is every time he stubs his toe, they're like, oh, he's not ready. He's mm-hmm. not ready. He's not ready. And it's like, man, guys make mistakes. Justin Hall, makes plenty of them. And I'm not even one of these get Justin Hall out of here guys, but it's just that's what happens when you play defense in the NHL. You're going to make mistakes, and especially for a 22-year-old, it's just he's never been able to get the run. If he had the run Dermott got, I firmly believe he would have established himself by now.
Yeah, a much tighter leash, it feels like. Not a lot of room for error, but also you need some time to put yourself in that position to grow in the NHL level. Like you can't see him playing in an AHL season trying to get to this level. Like it's got to be, there's got to be a position of comfort here, and it doesn't feel like that at all. And I also thought that Luke's point about him not having much leverage is the sticking point to me. It's like you're not coming from a position where you should be getting this massive contract. You should be getting a bridge contract similar to the other people that have just signed. So seems like they're worlds apart, and we gotta wait till training camp for anything is a bit sticky. But we got something good for the listeners. How about that?
Ooh,
we got something nice for the listeners now. We're giving away WWE tickets. This is the last day for our loyal listeners to win tickets. WWE coming to Scotiabank Arena on August 22nd, Monday Night Raw. We want to send you. We've been giving away tickets all week. We see you in the text line, and today's your last chance to win. Everyone's pulling out their phones right now. I feel it. Today's code word, Belair. You know, both of us were talking during the break. I'm like, it's Belair, right? Belair, B-E-L-A-I-R. We'll spell it for you. Belair. We'll spell it for you this time because nobody has ever correctly sent in the text. So Belair, 590. For your chance to win tickets to Monday Night Raw, this is your last chance, everybody. Belair. Good luck. And side note, to keep with the WWE talk, we got Edge on the show at 9 o'clock. Blake Murphy could not be more fired up. I'm being a nice co-host and letting him come on the Ailish Hour for that initial interview because I thought, you know what? It's good karma. Keep your co-host happy. Let's get him on to talk to his favorite guy, Edge. So you got to wait till 9 a.m. on the Ailish Hour for that. But yeah, text in Belair to 590-590.
That's awesome. Definitely text that in. I was wondering when I saw that if they were doing like a Fresh Prince storyline.
Yeah.
That's why that was the code word. That's honestly where my mind went when I
If you go look
that.
At the text line, like again, not one is spelled correctly. Like I spelled it for all of you.
You did.
We have Delair.
Literally not
Beware.
A one.
Beware. Blair, like Blair and Barker. No, it's not Jeff Blair.
Oh, this is great.
I think it's kind of a bit now. Like the last 4 days, the words have been simple. Like Edge was a word. You know, that one was spelled correctly. But the other three that we had, nobody, like maybe it's autocorrect coming in here. But
I think a lot of voice to text, I think. Yeah. Voice to text is hot in the streets.
I think they're trolling us. Like when someone texted in Edge, nah. I don't know. It's the wrong day.
Just listen to the pod.
Yeah, that's right. They're a couple days behind. Wait, let me give you a couple more CNE foods before we take a break and talk to Dan Shulman. This one I'm so in on. Like, could not be more excited. Flaming Hot Cheetos Smash Burger and a Flaming Hot Cheetos Burrito.
Done and dusted. That shouldn't be a CNE food.
No, that should be
That should be my breakfast. Is what that should be. A smash burger. Somebody asked me. This was during the Nathan's hot dog eating contest, and I was doing a show. What is the food item you could muck the most of? I honestly think it might be smash burgers. Now you throw in the flaming hot Cheeto dust. I don't know how many of those I'm getting down, but I've never been more in on a food. Again, that should not be a special restaurant or CNE food. I should be able to have that right now. That
10 inch so giant mozzarella sticks.
Give it to me.
Woo, okay.
Maybe you could dunk that in your ketchup ice cream.
Ooh, you ruined it. 2 foot long nachos.
Okay. I mean, I have some questions about the practicality of it all, like, but it sounds interesting.
The idea is fun, but how is the execution of this? Like, a foot long hot dog's already insane.
Here's where I think a 2 foot long nacho would be great. Is like if you're at the flight deck and you've got just a whole bunch of buds and it's just right in front of you and you're watching the game and you're just got this trough of nachos in front of you. I think that works. But like, I actually need to see someone carrying this away from whatever food stall sells it at the CNE. It's like it's got to be at least a 2-man job.
One more like incredible one, Croffles, a croissant waffle hybrid dessert.
Woo! I am a carb guy.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, I love carbs. Croissants, cheese buns, crepes, pancakes, waffles. Give it all to me. Any two carbs want to have a baby and get together with me, I'm
there you
in.
Go.
I am in on that.
Okay, wait. I have to do one more.
Yeah, do one.
Color-changing purple slime soda.
Okay,
well, I picture this like a lava lamp.
Yeah, that actually is exactly what it sounds like. I hope there's not like a glob or
orb. Oh, it kind of feels
it.
That way.
But this sounds like something I've got like a 2-year-old son. I would not want him to drink it because I feel like he'd never sleep again. But it feels like
he's
something
so hyper.
That would be very entertaining to him, color-changing soda.
Boy, a guy that often talks about the Looney Dogs on air. He's joining us next. Dan Shulman after the break. The Blue Jays are hot once again. Everything is fixed.
They're back. Everything's
fine. They're back, baby. Don't listen to the previous 2 weeks of the show because it's all good now. That's next on the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590 The Fan.